Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
And hello, everybody. This is Paul Lisnick, and welcome to this week's podcast, Behind the Curtain. We're doing something a little different today as we look back in history at a period of medical problems that still exist today. But, you know, now we're all in the world of COVID and dealing with everything that's happening. Well, you don't have to go back too many decades to realize that we had another incredibly terrible medical situation that the whole world was dealing with, and that, of course, is HIV/AIDS. Well, there's a brand new book called Plague Years, A Doctor's Journey Through the AIDS Crisis, written by Dr. Ross Slotin. And Dr. Slotin, actually a very well-known doctor in the Chicago community for sure. And during those days, he was also very well-known among AIDS patients and people who cared for AIDS patients. But as I read this new book, which just came out, even if you lived through that, it's an insider look that really opened your eyes to what was going on back then. So, Ross, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate it. And I'm going to start with my first question, which is, after all these decades since the AIDS crisis began, what led you to write what essentially now is a memoir of those days for you?
First of all, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. You know, this book was based on journals that I kept intermittently over about a 20-year period, and I thought about writing a book many, many years ago, but a number of other authors had really already written some wonderful books, and I kind of put those journals aside. But as time has passed and AIDS has remained a problem, although people with HIV, at least in this part of the world, are doing so well, I thought it was time to look back and kind of review this, you know, the disease itself. I mean, my career paralleled the epidemic from the very beginning, and so I was able to write about the entire arc of the epidemic from its worst days to the present time, where there's really hope and where people can, you know, presumably live to a normal lifespan.
You know, I lived through that period as well. I think we both knew people who suffered with it and died of it, and others who live with it today. And in reading the book, so many different things that caught my attention, one of which said, you realize that your job as a physician, you had to do more than diagnose and treat. You needed to confront death. Was that something? It seems as though your eyes got opened to that issue.
Well, it did. I mean, certainly being a doctor, even before HIV became a known disease, we were, you know, confronting death to some degree, but never in the kind of volume that I had come to expect. I mean, I certainly didn't expect to be caring for hundreds of people who were going to die, and especially people that were around my age. So yes, I was looking at death in its face almost every day, because not only was I dealing with death, but I had to reflect on my own mortality, because these were people that they were my peers.
I know you had thought that this would be sort of a almost maybe a scientific or a different kind of approach to the book, and in the end, it was friends of yours who basically said, "No, this needs to be a memoir," and I'm glad it was. Because by going through your career, we actually go through the pandemic, because as you said, you were there from the beginning, and you talk about the fact that as a young and new doctor, your first patients were essentially, you know, straight old people who are, you know, would come to you from the emergency room. And talk about that transition as you began to deal with what became recognizable as AIDS patients. And you even noticed that in the hospital, I know you changed some names, but you're truthful about the hospital you worked at and work at, which is St. Joseph's. You talk about the fact that this was not an easy thing for a lot of people to confront back then, a lot of fears.
Well, when I was trained as a family practitioner, which is basically sort of a newer version of a, the family doctor, the GP. And so my general training was from, you know, taking care of babies from birth and older people at their death. So I was trained to follow the entire arc of life. So when I started in practice, I certainly had no idea, because it was just back in the early 80s, that HIV would consume my life. I thought I would have just a general family practice, taking care of kids, taking care of adults, older people. But that transformed because, you know, being a gay man, and this is my community that was affected, my business partner and I made a decision that we were going to commit ourselves to taking care of people with this, not only this disease, but just gay men in general. So that transformed the practice. The hospital I worked at, you know, still work at St. Joseph Hospital, happened to be in the heart of the gay community. So a lot of the staff, a lot of the patients that came to the hospital were gay men and women. So it was sort of a natural evolution.
And of course, everybody always thinks like every pandemic, like a pandemic of COVID, whatever it is, it's never going to touch your life. It's never going to come into your world, but you're very candid in your writing. And we learn about a lot of relationships and friends that you went through. And one of which was actually one of your first partners who was Art, and the AIDS scare that you went through, that hit very close to home.
Well, yes. And that's why that's part of one of the themes in the book that although it was difficult to do this, I use my life and both my personal and professional lives as a mirror for the epidemic to try to help explain that to readers. So I had to put myself more on the line to kind of bring that out. But yeah, that was a very, very painful part of my life. I certainly went into that relationship not having any expectations that it would end the way it did.
And many of the chapters sort of walk us through the lives of various patients. It's almost guided by particular patients that you have in mind, again, assuming all these names are changed. But so when you do that, I mean, for example, one of the things that I didn't think about, you talked about people who found themselves homeless because a lot of young men were getting it at that time, and they were being shunned by their families and sent away, and then you would have to meet up with these folks.
You know, that's a story that's pretty well known in a way. But I think what to me was more remarkable is not so much the people that were cast away, but how many families embraced their children. That to me was probably a more startling reality, that, you know, especially parents that knew nothing about their child's sexuality and in many ways might find it abhorrent, wound up embracing their children. So I thought in my personal, now this doesn't necessarily experience of every physician who took care of people with HIV, but at least my particular population, many of my patients had a lot of support from surprising areas. So that to me was very heartwarming.
When you talk about you talked about a woman named Mrs. Cook. It was a different relationship. She was 90, I believe. But the point is, we also learn doctors develop very special relationships with their patients, right? I mean, and here's the thing. It's one thing to deal with a patient who's, you know, ill, or maybe they have a hernia or something you've got to deal with. And then sometimes there's that HIV test that was taken. You have to make that phone call to let them know. And you write in the book about it was not your style to say, hey, it's Dr. Slotin, call me. Because that would have been a panicky message for somebody to get.
Right. I mean, I think one of the things about being in primary care is that we're trained to really look at the person as a whole person, if you will. And I think that training sort of helped guide me as time passed in dealing with these crises that people were going through. And Mrs. Cook in particular, being 90, obviously I didn't have a very long relationship with her. She was a relatively new patient to me, but she taught me a lot. I mean, I made home visits. I mean, she ultimately died of a small cell cancer of the lung. But we developed this really wonderful rapport, and I think I carried that sort of lesson, if you will, to my patients as I progressed through my career.
You wrote about a professor named Gordon, and he was, there are other patients who, some of them didn't want to take the test. They're worried about the stigma. He was worried about people would think, and at one point you write in the book that you said to him, everyone's going to know how you got this disease. You can't hide it. Talk about the dynamics of having to deal with the patients who weren't accepting of it, who were resistant to testing. You wrote about patients who came in to see you, and you knew what was going on, but they didn't want to confront it.
Well, I think there was a dynamic there that kind of evolved. I mean, I think when back in the mid 80s, before just as we were developing testing for HIV, actually I would actually discourage people from being tested, because if they found out, what could we do about it? You get this information, then what do you do? There's nothing a person could do about it. But as the decade progressed and we started to be able to manage the infection little by little by little, then it became important to try to convince people to get tested so that we could intervene at an earlier point. So I wouldn't say that up front I encourage people to get tested, but there were people even later on when we had more effective therapies that would just refuse to be tested, and that was just part of the denial process of the disease. And that was a challenge, and I can't say that I always met that challenge, but I tried to work around it as best I could.
When you first started to confront dealing with the AIDS diagnosis with your patients who you knew the road they were ultimately going to walk down, certainly in those early years, but their family came along with it. And there's a lot of stories in the book of family members, mothers who would have to fly in to see their son somewhere. Basically, the partner or the mother, they're in the room when it's pretty clear to you the patient has passed away. Talk about the difficulty as a physician of having to deal with all of those relationships.
Well, I think if we're going to use the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross paradigm of how we move from, you know, diagnosis to death, I mean, it's not obviously a straightforward process. You're not only dealing with, you know, patients themselves and they're dealing with death, but you're also dealing with family members, and they may all be at different stages. So, for example, the patient might be in the acceptance phase, but the family might be in the denial phase. I mean, it's not a super, you know, it's not a strict progression, but having to deal with those dynamics can be quite tricky because on the one hand, the patient may have accepted the inevitability of his death, but a family member or a partner may not, and they may be in denial. So you're at loggerheads with those people. So that was a very tricky thing to have to navigate through. And every situation was completely different. So there was no one formula that I could follow.
I think a lot of people remember all the activism that went on, certainly in those early years. Daniel Sotomayor, for example. I can remember being in a meeting once, and Sotomayor, who was an AIDS patient, he ultimately died of AIDS, and he went up to Mayor Daley at the time, Richard M. Daley, and he would stand in front of him and just blow this whistle and blow this whistle, and Daley, who I was standing with Daley, and Daley looked and said, "I know, Danny, I know who you are, I know you're there." And of course, that was Sotomayor calling for action. What I found an especially touching sense of that was, as you probably know, when Sotomayor died, Mayor Daley went to his funeral. Talk to me about, and you were watching the politics, you're dealing with the actual illness, but you're also watching the politics evolve. You talked about going to New York, seeing the normal heart, just getting angry over the Reagan administration's dealing with it. Talk about the political piece of this.
Well, you know, as a physician, you know, I'm more of a physician, not a politician.
Yeah.
And so for me, I mean, not to say I stayed out of the politics, because obviously I did not completely, but I mean, to be both an activist and a physician were almost, you know, two opposite things in a way. I mean, I was so consumed by, you know, having to care for, you know, patients that's almost all my time was dedicated to that. And I really couldn't participate so much in, you know, in the activism, although I did go to meetings and that kind of thing. But obviously I was influenced by it. I was angry about it. I was, you know, angry with Reagan for marginalizing, in particular, gay men and ignoring this epidemic. So it sort of follows what's happening today. I mean, it's not unique to any era, but you know, when a new disease comes about, people oftentimes afflicting more marginalized people, politicians will push it aside and ignore things before they get out of control. So yes, there was anger. And what I find as a comparison to then, I mean, at that point, the government had been staying away from AIDS, and so activists were engaging the government to get more involved. And we find with COVID today that it's almost the exact opposite, that people are telling government to get out of their business. So it's really kind of an unusual comparative dynamic.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, but you've gone there, so let me just tap into that right now. As we go through the COVID situation, I'm assuming you have patients who have had and perhaps died of COVID. I don't know, but you don't write about that. But the question is, are there parallels between these two things other than that interesting point, which is government stay out of my life versus government not doing anything?
I think the main parallels are the arc of a disease. I mean, a new disease appears. There's, you know, sort of there are glimmers of it on the horizon. Then when it does appear, there's denial that it is going to be a serious problem. And by the time we realize it's a serious problem, it's almost out of our hands. I see that parallel. I do see it early on. There was some marginalization of people from Asia as being vectors of the disease, but that seems to have fallen away. But I think that the, you know, government being behind rather than ahead, is those parallels are very similar. Otherwise, they're very different diseases. HIV, if untreated, is almost universally fatal. I mean, 98% of people with untreated HIV would eventually die of consequence of HIV. COVID has a higher mortality rate than influenza, but the vast majority of people who get COVID will not die from it. The difference is that it's on such a larger scale so quickly that it can overwhelm the healthcare system, and we don't know how to manage that and other diseases simultaneously. So they're very different diseases, but I think the initial way we approach it is almost identically bad.
So today's version of stupidity, in my opinion, are those people who say, "I don't care if I get COVID, if I get it, I'm going to live," and just, you know, just walk into that risk. In the world of HIV and AIDS, one of the things I always had trouble understanding, but you write about it in the book, so you dealt with it, were people who wanted to get it. People who basically said, "I want to be infected." What is that all about?
Well, it's certainly what I on what scale I can't really say. I mean, I did have a small number of patients who actively courted it, and others who just were oblivious, probably denial to some degree. But the one person I write about in particular was a very depressed person. He was in his mid-50s, so he was not a young man. And, you know, he was my patient for a number of years before he became HIV infected. But for whatever reason, I could not talk him out of it. I couldn't find a way to dissuade him. He wanted his partner at the time, who was HIV positive, to infect him. And that's exactly what happened. And the course of his disease was one of the few instances where I actually could see how quickly the disease could progress in some individuals, because once he got infected, the next year was inexorably downhill, and he died literally a year after he got infected. But I would say that depression played a big role in his infection. Other people are, I think, if they get infected, it's almost like, you know, playing Russian roulette. It's that kind of thing. It's sort of like it's a denial that you might actually get the bullet. So there's some foreknowledge in a way, but there's the denial that you'll be the victim. I think that's part of it. I don't think in most people it's really a death wish. I think it's just sort of trying to defy death. Does that make sense?
When people try and categorize, okay, absolutely. And it makes me think of, again, something else in the book where you talk about in one case you dealt with a married man who was HIV positive, and he had to deal with his wife, and he was afraid of his wife knowing, and he had kids. And so, you know, again, every time you try and, you know, create a stereotype of who it was that was going to contract HIV/AIDS, you know, you're wrong. I don't mean you, but people were wrong, because it was in every lifestyle, including the story you write about, the married man with kids.
Well, he was a closeted gay man. He was also an immigrant, so there was a lot of stigma in the community that he grew up, that he was living in. And I think he spent his life hiding. And unfortunately, again, this happened in the late 80s, early 90s. He certainly didn't purposely infect his wife, but we had many conversations about his having safe sex with his wife, and he just wouldn't do it because it would then give a clue that there was something up that he didn't want his wife to know. And tragically, she became infected. But the reasons for his becoming infected and transmitting are very, very complex.
You also, again, when you lost your first partner to AIDS, you yourself went through AIDS testing. You write about it in the book. I know it's personal, but you wrote about it. So let me ask you, the fear that you must have had, and you write about it, I mean, almost breaking out in sweats, right, of just the fear of what if you had contracted it. And in many ways, I imagine you were very fortunate you did not.
Well, so I sort of violated my own edict, which was don't test if you can't do anything about it. But as I write in the book, that when the test became available, wasn't really commercially available, but I had a relationship with the Red Cross at the time, and they would send me people with HIV once they tested their blood. And so I asked the Red Cross if I could send samples to them for testing. And again, this is before commercial labs had it available, and they agreed to it. So I was the second person that I sent the blood sample to. But it was, you know, it was kind of foolhardy in a way, because if it had turned out to be positive, what was it going to do about it? How would it change things? It would have made me probably an emotional wreck. But by good luck, I was not positive. And I think that certainly changed the trajectory of my life, but I was still in utter terror before I got those results.
You also devoted so much of your life to world travel. I mean, if it's Tuesday, this must be Belgium kind of a life. I mean, in terms of going to Africa and so many different places in the world where you went to study. What comment do you have to make as you took a look at what the AIDS situation was in other countries in the world where you went to study and how it was being addressed here in the U.S.?
Well, originally, the first place I went to was Botswana, and I went there really as a visitor, not as as doing any sort of clinical research. It wasn't until a couple of years later when I went to Namibia that I actually did a small project. But it was very, you know, going to a different country, especially in that part of the world, it was very, very difficult to really, as a casual person, if you will, to really dig deeply during those visits to see what was happening behind the scenes. I think in that part of the world, especially in Namibia, which is in Southwest Africa, the epidemic was lagging behind the U.S., and there was a typical denial that there was a significant problem there. So the wave that hit us first hit later in Southern Africa. In fact, I remember in South Africa itself, in the early 90s, they didn't even think there was a serious problem. And then it would become later on one of the great problems of that country. So I think every nation approached it differently. I can't say I have anything more profound to say about it than that.
So I have to tell you, I read the book over a course of two nights. I could have read it in one night because it's engaging. It's easy to read. And I say that because your first book was called The Heretic in Darwin's Court, The Life of Alfred Russel Wallace, which is also on my shelf. That's taken me 3 years to try and get through. that was an incredibly scholarly, deep read. But here's what I love, Ross, is that in this book, that piece of who you are doesn't go away. There's all these references to Henri Matisse. And, as you read the book, it's that classic operatic guy in you that keeps showing himself in all of the analogies that you draw. You're aware of that, right?
Well, I did it purposefully. I wanted to make it sort of a richer narrative. I think those kind of allusions make a narrative more interesting. I think kind of deepen the story itself. So it was conscious. I mean, I can't say I was just writing things which just come to my mind, but I wanted to pepper the narrative with allusions like that.
And again, you write very personally. Your own relationships are detailed in it, where you are today, which is happily married, and all that is great. You talk about even, the very close relationship you had with your mom and going there one day to find that she had passed and you knew something was up. And I will tell you, as I had to write you immediately because I couldn't sleep, you walked into her apartment knowing what you were going to find, and her dog Chip was there barking, and I lost sleep over that because I worried about Chip as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously terrible. I mean, I had an intimation that was going to happen. My mother's death was fairly swift, but she had a relatively rare leukemia that had been diagnosed 2 or 3 years before that, but then she began to have more problems about 6 months before she died. And so I would call her 2 or 3 times a day just to see how she was doing. And literally one day, it was a Saturday, she had gone out to lunch with some friends. And when I called her that night, she said she was tired. The next morning when I called her, I couldn't understand a word she was saying. And when I came to her home, she was clearly had pneumonia, but she absolutely refused to go to the hospital. She would accept no antibiotics, and she wanted nothing. She just wanted to be left alone. And I knew at that point that something terrible was going to happen. And so although it was a shock, it was truly not a surprise when I called her and she didn't answer. And when I entered the house, there was, the radio wasn't on, the dog was at the door. I knew something was bad. It was a terrible but not surprising moment.
And by the way, for animal lovers like me.
Yes. And, then my mother used to say, we always convinced my mother to get this dog, Chip. And she said, this dog's going to outlive me. What's going to happen? She would say things like that. So, we'll take care of it. Don't worry if that happens, And that's indeed, we took care of it. My brother in Florida has, and Chip is still alive. He's like 14, but he's doing well.
And finally, Ross, what for people who know you, of course, they'll enjoy reading this and reading about your life. For those who don't know you around the country, what message do you want to have them get out of the book?
I think, first of all, the book in some ways is directed toward younger people who don't know anything about HIV or had no experiences with it. To me, it's like a Holocaust memoir, if you will, and that's why I thought it was important. I look at this as a historical book. I mean, yes, it's about my life in a sense, but that's my life as a mirror for this disease. But I think there's sort of an unintended message of the book, which is, and this is related to COVID, that we have not solved AIDS, but we figured out a way around it in a way so that people who are universally condemned to die can now probably live a normal lifespan if given appropriate treatments. And I think with COVID, we don't know how this is going to end, but we will find our way through it in some fashion. We can't see it now, but we will find a way. And that, to me, the book offers a note of optimism. That's how I see it.
And that's the sense I got out of it as well. The book is called Plague Years, A Doctor's Journey Through the AIDS Crisis, written by Ross Slotin, MD. Pick it up on Amazon or wherever good books are sold. Ross, congratulations on this book. It was wonderful, and I look forward to to the next book on the heretic in Darwin's court. We'll go back to that topic, I suppose. But anyway, congratulations. Be well. I wish you all the luck with this. I hope everybody checks this out. Thank you.
And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's P-A-U-L-L-I-S-N-E-K. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.